That was mean. I honestly didn't mean that. I didn't mean that how that. Okay, you guys, we have to keep you updated on what's been going on since we saw you last. Remember last time Quinn was talking about how sick she was? Guess what? It's been how many days?
Nothing has changed. It's day 14.
This is your spirits are high.
I actually feel a little better today than I did the last 4 days. I would say like Monday and Tuesday were good. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'm still feeling weird. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday were nightmares. And today I'm waking up and I'm like, you know what?
You don't want
to
kill
yourself?
I can totally
get up and make my kid waffles, but I can't walk them to school. You know, like I got up and did the breakfast and Matt walked them.
Oh,
but
man.
I'm starting to be able to do things. And I have like 7 hours of school today. So I'm just going to go because you can just wear a sweatsuit and avert gazes and get counted as present, which is very important when you're going to Costa Rica in a week.
I'm very happy you're going to Costa Rica. I think you're going to have an incredible time.
You do?
I'm so sorry you've been sick. I really am. It's because you are such an active person, and the idea that you've been sequestered, like,
I love going to the gym and I love like cooking and all the little things that like make winter bearable for me haven't been happening. But I will say this, I've really been leaning into the lazy, you're like, oh, like I fought the illness the first week, I didn't cancel any of our plans and I just kept showing up to things,
yeah,
and being like, I can do this. And then like I remember going to a dinner party and pouring myself a glass of wine, and it was one of those dinner parties where everybody had like 5 glasses of wine, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, and I poured myself a glass of wine and I just held it all night and kept carrying it around with me and opening another seltzer, and at the end of the night I still just had the glass of wine, like it was this weird prop where I was like in denial. So I just had this like prop wine. I was like pretending to drink, and I was like, wow, I'm really sick. I could not even drink a little of this wine.
That's how you know it's bad.
When your body's like, absolutely not.
But I have been loving our soup diet. We've had some like really delicious soups.
Right?
It feels very healthy.
Carrie moved in and I was like, here's the new thing. You cook soup every day.
And I feel like I've had a lot of really great experience. I now, you know, like I can cut a mirepoix with the best of them.
She can fillet a monkfish.
Monkfish, new journey. And I was like, I also learned not a flaky fish. You know, these are things that's like
they
I'm taking
it
with
to
me.
Lobster.
They do liken it to lobster. So that's when I was cooking it. I was like, this is getting firmer, not flaky. But it was, listen, we've had delicious soups and they're very hearty soups and it's felt good for me. And then a friend of ours, Quinn's, dropped off a rotisserie chicken. And so, which was like, we made a rotisserie chicken broth, which was delicious. And it was simmering all day. So it was like some good cozy vibes, you know, and I think after coming back to New York and like hitting the ground running, it was good to sort of take a pause and be like, okay, here you are. You're landing, and that's okay. That's okay. So I've appreciated.
You're going to be so excited when we leave town and you're allowed to cook something other than soup.
I don't know. I mean, it was so funny. Like yesterday, Matt was going to cook the soup, and I came in and I was like, I got this. Because I genuinely like to cook. And also,
I thought you were
going
to say, because I don't like to watch him struggle.
Well, I want to be a contributing member of this environment, and also I really like cooking, and I came back and I think I was procrastinating doing other things that I needed to do, like log on to work or figure out money stuff or there were things I needed to do that I was like, you know what, I'd much rather like see an end product mm-hmm. on the table at
Isn't
the end.
So nice. That's my
it's
favorite.
So
thing
satisfying.
Like, it happened. I did it.
Oh like, look
These
at this thing I made.
Pictures of you and Griffin are so good.
Do you
I
love
feel like,
them?
Oh my God. He's like the cutest person ever born.
Griffin, when I came in and the first time I saw Griffin and Koa, it was very special. They were like so jazzed to see me, which again made me very, very happy because I seek validation in the hearts and minds of a 4 and a 7-year-old. And they just were so cute. And I can't like they've gotten bigger. Like it's so fun. I hadn't seen them for like 2 months. And it's just when you don't see kids for that long, they just get bigger. And yeah. It's very fun. It's very, very fun.
Well, I know you don't have a ton of time. Did you want to just jump into stories?
Do we have anyone to thank?
No. Ourselves hey, for showing up.
I want to thank Quinn. I want to thank you for opening your home and your heart to me and your family. And I want to thank the Academy of Podcast Recording, of which does not exist, but hopefully it will never exist. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay, so you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creeply.
Guys, I have a story, and I think I go first.
I think I go first.
But who's right? You know what I mean?
I think it's, here's the thing. It's if it's an odd episode, because you're odd, you go first. That's how I remember it. So I teased this story last week. So last week I watched At Wit's End, the Melissa, you're right there, friend? Oh my God.
This
no,
room is filled
no,
with toys.
No.
Why?
I know
this
why.
This is my tidy room.
I know why. Because Koa and Griffin were in there and they were making a wedding. And that is the creepiest fucking puppet. Please hold it up to the screen.
I mean, no one I don't, can see it but you.
But maybe I'll post this on Instagram. I've been taking videos. I need to post them.
Okay.
Look. that is a puppet that Matt McCroskey made at the age of 10. And I think he called it Fat Man
it's
instead of
scary.
Batman. It's
There's
so...
There's too many stuffies in here. I feel outnumbered, overwhelmed, and afraid. I feel afraid.
I think that's actually fair. But again, they had me set up all their stuffies. Koa brought all of them down from upstairs because they were doing a wedding ceremony yesterday. That's
okay,
what.
Well,
the,
if the wedding's over, I'd like them to please leave. Like, that, how
this
long
is they're
is
overstaying their welcome. They're overstaying their welcome. Okay, so I teased this last week. I covered the story of Melissa Witt and the cold case surrounding her. Her disappearance and murder. And they mentioned a similar case, and there was a documentary on it, and it's called Still Missing Morgan. And if you can surmise, this is going to be a frustrating ending by the title of which I read. Still spoiler. Missing Morgan. So spoiler alert, it was a 4-part hour-long series, and I know it's frustrating, but I spent 4 hours researching this or watching this, so I'm going to cover this case, and that's the deal. So we are in Ozark, Arkansas. It's 1995, and if you remember, around that time is exactly when Melissa Witt, last week's case, went missing. She was ultimately found dead, and her murderer is still at large. It's a cold case. But it's around the same time, around the same place. I don't know if I clarified this. Melissa went missing in Arkansas in 1995, and she was discovered near Ozark, Arkansas in 1995. So just so we're clear, the body was discovered around where Morgan is from. So the family is a military family. They've traveled quite a bit. And so by the time 1993 rolls around, they're done touring the military bases and they decide to head home. John Nick is the father and Colleen Nick is the mother. Now, I would pronounce her name Colleen, but everyone in Arkansas pronounces it Colleen. So Colleen Nick, she's a stay-at-home mom and she decides... But, and she says she's a stay-at-home mom, but I want to make a note. She also says that she got her daycare license for at home, so she also is taking care of other kids. So I actually wouldn't call her a stay-at-home mom. She has a home-run daycare, but she talks about the value of being home with her kids and how much she loves doing it. There's home video of the family, and you can tell how in love she is with her daughter. Her daughter is the oldest of three kids. She's really cute. She has blonde hair. She's 6 years old. It's 1995. In fact, her mom was working super hard. She was having overnight daycare at her house. She was doing weekend daycare at her house. And at this time, she goes, you know what? I'm going to stop doing the overnight and weekend because I want to spend more time with my kids. So it's June 9th, 1995. Morgan is 6 years old. And the two of them are going out to Elma to watch a Little League baseball game that was rescheduled. And it was pretty late, I would say, for kids playing, but there's lights and it's this baseball field that's, there's two benches, one at first base, one at third base. It's not like a part of a big park district. There's a little sandy area where people park their cars. I wouldn't say it's a baseball field, but it's not like a part of a very nice park district area. It's pretty utilitarian in its sort of appearance. But it's pretty late. They're a block away from the police department. Colleen had dropped her two youngest kids off at her mom's house, and she and Morgan go to the game. I think it was like a friend of theirs. This baseball field, just to be clear, doesn't even have concessions. It's not one of those places. So they're on the bleachers. It's dark out. The kids are all playing. There's some home footage of this baseball game happening, which, interestingly enough, the home footage that they refer to in this episode is the footage from the mother of one of the police detectives who was investigating Melissa Witt's case from last week. Just like small town vibes. Everyone is super connected. So in this home footage, you can like see them very blurry in the background. And these two kids are playing. They're running around. One is 8, one is 10. So they're 2 and 4 years older than Morgan. And they keep asking Morgan if they want to play. And Colleen is known as an overprotective mother. And so she's like, no, it's too late. It's too dark out. I can't see where everything is. No, you cannot play. Mm-hmm. And so the kids keep coming back and asking Morgan. And Morgan's 6. And these kids are asking her to play. And so finally she's like, I really would like to play. And she's doing that thing in the bleachers where she's untying her mom's shoes. And her mom's like, what? You untied my shoe? Very 6-year-old vibes. So finally these kids come over and they're like, we're catching fireflies. Morgan, can you please come? And she looks at her mom and she's like, please, mommy, can I please go? And her mom is being interviewed in the show. And she says, in my mind, in my heart, I heard, Colleen, you're being overprotective. The kids are fine. They're all within eye distance. It's fine. Let them go. And when she told Morgan she could go, Morgan got so excited. She hugged her mom around the neck. She gave her a kiss on the cheek. And then she ran away to play. She's wearing, by the way, like a green Girl Scout shirt. And a funny story about that is she had signed up for cross country or track or something. And she came home and she was like, mom, you're not going to believe what they made me do. I had to run outside and I was sweating. And her mom was like, that's what track is. And then she was like, actually, I'd like to join the Girl Scouts because we can stay inside and color or like paint. She was very cute. Sure. So, and I get it. So she's wearing her little Girl Scout green shirt. And she runs off to play with the kids. And the three of them are at the parking lot. There's a bunch of sand around just from unsettled dirt. They're catching fireflies. Ty is 10. Jessica is 8. They're in the parking lot. They run between two fences. They go in front of the cars. And so when the game is over, the parents call the kids. The three of them start to run, but Morgan's shoelace is untied. So the 1 8-year-old Jessica, she runs. Ty waits for little Morgan. She's 6 years old, waits for her to tie her shoes. And as she's finishing, he turns around and he runs towards the baseball field. The two of them return to their parents, and Morgan never shows up.
What the fuck?
We know the kids were playing in the sand pit. We know she tied her shoes, and I guess she wasn't fully done. And it's 10:40 at night that they start to look for her when she doesn't. And so they're going, you know what? Maybe she just walked off. She got distracted. It's fine. So they start to look for her, but Morgan is nowhere to be seen. And they realize she's missing. The police is a block away. So the public then start looking. And at this point you're having like a ragtag group of parents. It's every parent's worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. And so all these parents are just searching high and low for this kid. It's pretty disorganized, but it's just like, people on the ground, just look. The kids who are with her are interviewed, and they say they saw a guy in shorts. Maybe he was shirtless. Maybe his shirt was open. He maybe had a little hair on his chest, and a red truck with a camper top that doesn't quite fit. So at this point, they have very little to go on. Nobody can really identify this truck. Nobody stepped forward and say, hey, that was my truck, or that's my friend's truck that was at the parking lot. So they really don't have anything. They don't have any DNA. They take cigarette butts and cans from the parking lot. They collect any evidence that they can. But at this point, she just vanished in thin air. Colleen is being used as the mother in the media. There was this very interesting moment where they were interviewing her father, John. And he's one, someone that really wasn't present in the media. So a lot of people believed that he didn't care. When in reality, they didn't want to hear from him. And then he got spiteful because they wanted to focus on her mother. Because, and I understand why. It's like, I think the mother appealing from a media perspective is very effective to build compassion. And I think, but the public sort of turned on her father, like he didn't care. And the police at the time is like, no, he was super cooperative, but we were carting out Colleen to the media, and she was doing everything she could to appeal to whoever took her, to find her daughter, anything. John also talks about his experience of, at first he was super angry that they didn't want to talk at him. And then he would like laugh at them. And then he had this moment of acceptance where he's like, if they're talking shit about me, my daughter's name is still in their mouth. And as long as people are talking about Morgan Nick, there is still a chance we can find out what happened to her. It's over 20 years. And in 2019, a new lead detective is appointed to the case. And there's not much more information we've gotten. They built like sort of a sketch of who they look like based on the kids' descriptions. But again, like that's all they have, this like red truck and this description. They have, people are putting forth their home movies, and some people think they saw this red truck with a camper fitting in this video in the background, but it's a 1990s camcorder. Like it's very blurry. Maybe it's a door in the red truck. Like they can't totally tell the perspective. So in 2019, a new lead detective is appointed, and he decides to start from the very beginning, which is a very good place to start. He starts going through lots of leads that came in, and he's like, from the composite drawings, there were like 8,300 leads, but he's like, I'm not interested in looking at this composite. I think there's something in this red truck. And what's interesting is he starts looking at what happened around that time. Around that time, there was a lead that was called in where a young woman earlier that day was in downtown Alma, and this red truck started following her, and the car didn't leave. And she walks further, and like he offers her a ride, and she's like, no. She walks off, he sits there, and then drives off. So that's just like a little, her blink goes off, and I think she reports it at the time. Around the same time, there were two girls that came home, and they were around 5 and 6, and they were crying. And their mom looks out and she sees the red truck with a white camper top sort of like drive away. Another moment happens where there's two boys who gets hassled by this guy in a red truck, is like, watch where you're going. It's like a grumpy guy. And then this truck leaves. There's another instance where some boys in the road get yelled at by a truck with a white a red truck with a white camper van. And then there's that video. This detective is tracking this red truck based on eyewitness at the time and compiling, instead of using the composite drawing, he's like, let's find the whereabouts of this, because there were a couple of weird moments with these red trucks that we need to figure out the journey of it. And then there's an eyewitness account of a group of teenagers after Morgan went missing. It would be in the timeline. They were driving. I think they were just being like teenagers in the back roads of Arkansas. And they passed by a red truck on the side road, and they recall it sitting there, and they think they saw a man like pushing a young girl down in the front seat. Again, eyewitness is super unreliable, but this is truly the only evidence or the only sort of path or idea of what the hell is going on with these kids.
Yeah.
At this point, they're focusing on this black truck. I mentioned last time, Charles Ray Vines. They're looking at like other people convicted of crimes around that time. Now, if you remember Charles Ray Vines, he primarily attacked older women in their home. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things where his MO doesn't totally match up with this. Mm-hmm. But then they start to look at this guy, Billy Jack Lynx. What's interesting about Billy Jack Lynx is that 2 months after Morgan's kidnapping, he was arrested for solicitation of a child. And coincidentally enough, he has a red truck. Mm-hmm. It's so crazy to me that these weren't connected, but I think mm-hmm. they were investigated at the time, but they came back with nothing. And also mm-hmm. it's 1995 when this happened. And so DNA is not anywhere near advanced as it is. And circumstantial evidence is not going to get people indicted. But of mm-hmm. course, this guy was a person of interest. That being said, let's talk about Billy Jack Lynx. One, it's a name that means he should be in jail. Billy Jack Lynx. So it's at the Sonic. This 11-year-old girl is with her two guy friends, and they're getting pops and fries. And this guy in a red truck comes up, and he starts asking them to come to him, whatever. He also asks the boys to go buy something at Sonic, leaving the girl alone. Mm-hmm. And the boys wouldn't. And then the girl, who's 11 years old, is pretty skeptical, and so she's farther back.
Yeah.
And then he drops a cigarette butt on the floor, and he asks by his car, and he asks her to pick it up, and she says no, which I think saves her life, because if she had gone by the truck to pick it up, he could have knocked her out and gotten her in the car. So she reports this. She runs to the Sonic to call the police because she's like, this guy is crazy. He's offering her money, asks her for like just really bad stuff. She's 11 years old. Her blink goes off. She tries to go to the police. Billy Jack Lynx freaks out, and he tries to drive away, but he hits a pole. And so someone comes out, is able to see his license number. Is like, this is very suspicious, writes it down, and they're able to find this guy, and he's arrested for solicitation of a child.
Got it.
What's interesting about Billy Jack Lynx is he has a history. In fact, mm-hmm. 3 years before Morgan's abduction, he was accused of abusing his granddaughters. And I think he was actually charged with it. But what's disgusting, and this is very indicative of 1995, is he did no time. He just got 10 years probation for Whoa. Sexually abusing his Whoa. Own grandchildren. So he has 10 years probation, but it feels like he has not been punished, and he is a predator. And also, if you look at his victims, Levin is older than six, but at the same time, like, he is a predator of children. And this brazen attempt at an attack of this 11-year-old girl at Sonic would mean mm-hmm. he's pretty outgoing
yeah.
and pretty safe in his attempts to kidnap a person pretty publicly, which would, for I think a lot of people going, maybe that's more evidence of him hurting Morgan.
Right. It doesn't look like round one.
Exactly. So
this is not his first rodeo.
This is something they're looking into in 2019. And at this point, he's dead, which is very frustrating. So we can't get him to admit to what he did. At one point, they had the truck in their possession, and the police said they processed it, but none of the evidence can be found from Link's truck, which could benefit because they could maybe find Morgan's DNA. They could have mm-hmm. found blood spots. Like, we don't know. In fact, on the bench seat, I guess there was blood, but they just can't find it in the system, mm-hmm. which again would have been, if they found Morgan's DNA, we would have a little bit more information. And so what happens is they just start trying to find this truck. And again, it's been like 30 years later or 20 years later, 25 years later. And miracle of miracles, they're able to find the truck. It had been sold from person to person, but they find the VIN number and they're able to match the truck. They go and get the truck and they're trying to find any evidence. Again, this is 25 years after the fact. Mm-hmm. They find a blonde hair in the truck. And so they're trying to match and see if it could be Morgan's. They find some blood splatter. But at this point, the DNA has degraded. They can confirm it's blood, but they cannot confirm who it belongs to, because at this point, the DNA degrades and there's no way they can match it. The one thing that they do find within the truck, though, is they find fibers in the floorboards of the truck, mm-hmm. and they send it in. And what the police do have is they have the matching shirt that Morgan was wearing when she disappeared, that Girl Scout shirt. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to compare the fibers that they find in this truck to the fibers in her shirt. And they find that the fibers match the control shirt that they have. They're the same greenish blue fibers. Mm. And what's interesting is when a shirt gets to that point, it has to go through processing, dyeing, things like that. And if they're able to match it, it's highly unlikely that the fibers found in the truck would come from another material. That being said, it is not a guarantee that it's her shirt.
Right.
Now, the whole time Colleen is navigating this grief, and I found the documentary to be the most compelling about this mother who's not given up hope. And she meets this woman, Patty, who is the mother of another missing child. And I will get into his case another time because it's absolutely fascinating. Colleen discusses how in cases like Morgan, there is a 2% chance that after 2 years, that child is alive.
Yeah.
And how she is operating is, if there is a 2% chance my kid is alive, I will never stop fighting for her. And if when I die, they'll give up, and I'm not giving up that fight. She, of course, as we've seen time and time and time again, she has started a foundation called the Morgan Nick Foundation, where she helps families locate their child. And you can tell this is something that she holds near and dear to her heart. And there's these conversations with her and Patty talking about, when do you give up? When is enough enough? And their response is quite simply, never. Until she knows certainly what happened to her daughter,
Yeah. She's
not going to give up. Her interviews were so heartbreaking. And she talks about these moments. But of course, as any mother, she has the regret of letting her daughter play. And this overprotective part of her that was criticized, she has such regret. And I think there was this other story that she shared about how before they went to the baseball game, she made her kids grilled cheeses. And Morgan wanted another grilled cheese, but she didn't have time to make it. And she lives with the regret of not making her daughter the second grilled cheese. The case of Morgan Nick
so funny what is still open. Like that, you know?
Well, she's going back towards everything. And she's not given up hope. I think in this documentary, it's very much her keeping the story alive and making sure. And I think kudos to the Arkansas Police Department for continuing to investigate this cold case. They've not given up. The best lead, the way the documentary ended, was this sort of revelation of the fiber in the bed of this truck matching. Now, again, any shirt with that color dye could be, like, it's not enough to pin the murder on him, but it does feel like, especially with all these places, I don't know if they'll ever find Morgan Nick. And without DNA, without truly knowing where she is, and furthermore, the day after she left, like, there was flooding in the area. They have cadaver dogs. They found nothing. Mm-hmm. It's just, everything feels, it was very hard to watch because you saw things just keep hitting a brick wall.
Yeah. It's like a perfect storm, literally.
Yeah. Yeah. It was heartbreaking. So that's the story of Morgan Nick that I wanted to share with you. My heart breaks at Colleen and Herfley and John, Morgan's father. But these videos of these young girl was just, she was a very special little kid. I mean, all kids are very special, and she was no exception.
I am going to tell you this crazy story. Well, let me, you know what? I'm going to start by telling this story from a letter that the bereaved brought into a news station. I got my information from Westword Court Cases and the Denver Post. So this is a Colorado situation. I'm just going to start with this letter that Ralph Candelero brought into the press that explains, in his words, what happened. For purposes of this letter, Pam is his wife. Tuesday evening, Pam and I had dinner at about 6:30. She made chicken and rice. We had half a glass of red wine each with dinner. Then we sat down to watch some TV, some Frasier, some Star Trek Voyager, and White Collar. Pam took her bath at 9 and I took mine at 9:30. We were both in bed by 10:30 approximately. The morning of January 15th, 2014, at about 2:30, I got up to go to the bathroom, went out of the bedroom into the hallway upstairs, and noticed a downstairs light was not on. So I went to check why. I heard something downstairs as I got to the bottom of the railing. I turned and someone hit me in the back. I tripped forward and went toward the front door when someone else hit me in the head from the side room. I got a glimpse of this person, a tall, dark man with yellow glasses, short, curly hair, wide nose, large lips, and marks on the sides of his face. I could not see his eyes or ears. A moment later, I was lying on the floor unconscious. I don't know how long I was there on the floor, but I started to hear noises. Noises upstairs, noises in the kitchen. No lights anywhere were on. I knew something was wrong. My head hurt. I was dizzy. I could not see clearly, but I tried to get up a couple of times and finally stumbled towards the kitchen. I turned the light on by the kitchen sink and found Pam lying on the floor by the cupboard. She's alive, but she's badly hurt. There's blood all over her face and all over the floor. I yelled at her, but she did not respond at all. She was breathing hard and blood was coming out of her nose and mouth. I tried to clear her mouth, but she was bleeding and it wouldn't stop. She started to convulse and I held her hand for just a couple of minutes and she went quiet. I yelled at her again and just started crying. She did not respond and was no longer breathing. I just collapsed down on the floor by the sink. A moment later, the two guys ran downstairs and told me to shut up. The taller man took me to the front hall and told me to get down and to shut up. And when I lay down on the floor, I was crying and he kicked me in the side and told me to shut up. They were speaking in Spanish, but the tall one did speak to me in thick English and told me not to move or make any noise. They turned the kitchen light out. They both had some kind of LED lights on the sides of their gloves. Something was wrong with them. The tall guy was talking on a phone in Spanish. I don't know what phone he was using. I could only determine he was very angry. Something was wrong with the car. I could not tell what. He told the shorter guy they'd have to wait a while. He told me not to move. Some time went by. Don't know how much. He came back and asked me if I had any more money. I told him I had a couple of stashes upstairs and in the garage. He told me to go get them. He followed me to the kitchen where I put on my tennis shoes to go to the garage. He took out a small handgun and told me he'd be watching. I went out the back and the rear door glass was broken. Some pieces fell out when I opened the door. I continued to the garage where I tried to lift myself up into the loft. I had an old shotgun in the loft with a couple of shells, but I couldn't pull myself up, so I grabbed the $200 I had under the candle and went back out. When I turned around, I saw Ferry, Trujillo's husband, in the back in his yard. That's their neighbor. I always wave at him, but the tall guy was standing by the bathroom window with his gun looking at me, so I just looked straight forward and I didn't wave. I didn't even look over. I thought maybe he might think that was strange and come and check on us. Nobody ever came. When I went in, more glass fell. I was sure someone would hear. I think it was about 5 now because there was some traffic starting to move around. Once I was inside, I told them it was cold and I needed to keep the fire going. So I went back out to get a couple of pieces of wood for the stove, but I could not see Ferry's husband, so I brought the wood in. But when I picked up the poker to stir up the fire, I saw blood on the end of it, and I put it down and told them I would just turn the electric on. I turned the heater on in the TV room, but the tall guy would not let me stay. He took me to the hallway and told me to lay down and stay. I just broke down. I was crying, and I was cold. I was freaked out. Pam was there with me just a few feet away. I grabbed a small pillow off a bench and a small blue knit blanket to cover myself, and I just cried. I either passed out or fell asleep exhausted and cold. The next bit of memory comes at about 11 a.m. on Wednesday morning. The tall guy was talking angrily on his phone about the car, telling them something, then cursing, puta, you puta, more, but I don't know much Spanish. They were in the TV room and I asked if I could go to the bathroom. He followed me upstairs to the bathroom and I went to the bathroom and then washed my hands and face and saw my face was absolutely swollen above my left eye and I had a cut on my nose. I went across the hall to the sitting room and got my slippers, took off my tennis shoes and went down the hallway. I turned to go in the bedroom, but he told me no and said down. I was trying to get my phone. It was on the bedstand. He told me to lay down and be quiet. Around 1 o'clock, some glass fell out of the back door. The guys ran into the fireplace room and closed the door. I thought someone might be checking the house, but it turned out to be the wind. Still nobody. Why did no one ever come by? I still don't understand. In the afternoon, he called someone again about the car and started cursing again, you puta, and other things. About 4 o'clock, things took a turn for the worse. The tall guy was still angry and thought he would come over and kick me. I was just resting on the floor. Then he pointed his gun at me and fired. It just clicked. I can't fully say what happened to me at that point. This continued for almost an hour. I lost all control of myself. I shit in my pajamas. I peed in them also, all over myself, and they just laughed. I was just laying there in my own shit and they were laughing. I just broke down altogether. I passed out at some point because when I woke, it was dark outside. Only the light from the street was coming in. I thought how nice it looked, and it was quiet. But I realized I was freezing. I couldn't stop shaking. I got up and went to the TV room and lay down in front of the heater, just crying, shaking. I smelled terrible. I lay there for a while when I decided I would try to go upstairs and clean myself up, but the tall guy came in from behind the fireplace room and told me to shut up and lay down on the floor. He told me, "Do you want to die?" I said, "No." He said, "Shut up, and I mean forever, or I will come back and finish you." I just said okay and lay back down on the floor. I couldn't help myself. I just peed all over myself again. It was more than I could deal with. I passed out again. When I awoke, the sun was coming up and the light was in the house. I thought my nightmare was over, but I looked down the hall and I could see Pam's legs in the kitchen. I couldn't hear anything and the fireplace doors were closed. When I couldn't hear anything, I mean there was absolutely no sound. No voices, no traffic, no dogs, nothing. I was so cold and dizzy, but I got myself up and went over to Pam and just lost everything. I yelled. I pissed my pajamas again. I just went for the front door. I didn't think. I just went, maybe someone could help me. Someone was near. I stumbled down the front steps and saw Fairy over to my right, and I yelled to her for help. I was walking. I made it to the second set of steps and went down, but when I turned to go to her, I lost my balance and fell on the sidewalk and hit the right side of my head. I asked her for help for me and for Pam to check on her, and I remember her calling 911, then I lost focus. I was so cold on the concrete, but I was already freezing. When the paramedics arrived, I remember them talking to me, but I don't remember what. I vaguely remember them cutting my clothes off. I was shaking and I couldn't stop. The next thing I remember was the hospital. They were trying to warm me up and get an IV into me, and then they were trying to clean me up. The next thing I remember was riding in the helicopter. It hurt my head worse. It vibrated all the way and made me sick. When they got me to Parkview, they gave me a warm IV and blankets and some morphine for the pain, and I started to feel better. Sometime in the ER, a gentleman came over to take pictures of my injuries to my head, my ribs, my arm, and my face. I can't remember his name. Also, Greg Sudar from CBI came to talk to me to ask what happened. I tried to tell him as much as I could, but at the time I was still in shock, and all I could really remember was getting hit in the head. I really could not remember what had happened all that last day. I thought everything had happened that morning. That's what I believed. After some more x-rays and a CT scan, the doctor said I had a concussion and said I was stable and could go home. My son Aaron came to pick me up, but Greg and Kurt Liebchen said they would give me a ride to CBI and I could go, so I said okay. Little did I know what trauma was to unfold next and how badly I was to be treated for the next 11 hours. I was mistreated, bullied, intimidated, tortured, and coerced for the next 11 hours. Yes, I repeat, 11 hours. Kurt took me to the CBI office in Pueblo around 1, and they said they needed to ask me a few questions about what happened. I said, okay. When I got there, they said they needed to take my fingerprints. I didn't understand, but I said, okay. They asked me questions for about 40 minutes, I guess, while I waited for the fingerprints. I asked if I could get a drink or something to eat, and if I could get my prescription. They gave me a drink, but said no to everything else. And I asked Greg if I could get at least some Tylenol, and he said he couldn't do that. Finally, they took my fingerprints and then asked me more questions. Then let me sit on a couch, and I fell asleep for a while. They woke me up later, and I was cold and asked for a blanket or some clothes, and they said no. They then took me to a small cold room, sat me down on a cold vinyl chair, and proceeded to grill me about what happened. At first, they were pleasant and just asked what I could remember. And after a while, they became rude and threatening. I was still dizzy. I was tired. I was traumatized. I was cold. I didn't have any clothes. I was also hungry. But I tried to answer the questions. I told Pat and Kurt all that I could remember about last night. That I went downstairs to check the light in the stove. When I got to the bottom, I got hit from behind and got hit in the head above my right eye and knocked out in the hallway by the front door. I couldn't remember anything until I woke up in the morning and found Pam on the kitchen floor. I told them I went over to check on her and she was cold, not breathing, and did not respond. and that I just peed in my pajamas and ran out the front door and yelled to Ferry to please stop and help me and check on Pam. I said I did remember that evening before when we had dinner and watched TV and took our baths and went to bed around 10:30. They seemed angry with me that I couldn't remember more, but what was I to do? I had just lost my wife. I was injured. I was hungry. I was cold, and I was not allowed any medical treatment. How could anyone think under those circumstances? I ask again, how? What I told them was accurate from my memory. I was just missing a whole day, and I couldn't figure out why. I even asked Greg why I would have dried feces on me if it had occurred to me that morning. He said he didn't know. Why I smelled so bad, like I hadn't showered in days, I wanted to know. Well, about 6 o'clock, Pat and Kurt finally got me a hamburger and a drink, which I thanked them for and ate, not even realizing myself that I had not eaten since Pam's dinner on Tuesday night. They told me someone else had come to talk to me from Denver and it would be a couple of hours. So I leaned on my cold vinyl chair, propped my head up and fell asleep exhausted, hurt and cold, without my medicine, without my clothes, in paper clothes, no shoes, no underwear. All I could do was sleep. The gentleman from Denver turned out to be a polygraph guy who explained he needed to give me a test, explained how to do it, and asked if it was okay, and I said yes, okay. This took about 45 minutes, and he said he needed to grade the test and would come back. In a while, he did and explained that I knew more about the evening than I was saying, which in retrospect is true, but I could only remember what I could remember. But then it got worse, more so than you could imagine. At about 10:30 p.m. on Thursday, Pat and Kurt came back loaded for bear. They came out and said I knew more than I was telling, and they pieced together a story for me. Then they decided to bash Pam, saying she was an alcoholic and a drunk, and she and I had been drinking heavily, and we got in an argument, and things got out of hand. It gets worse. After about an hour of this, I told them I was not involved in the hurt Pam suffered, that we were happy, and that we were not arguing, that we were getting ready to go on our long-planned vacation to our home in Oregon. Then they changed tactics by telling me it was okay if I agreed to self-defense. I was shocked, even insulted. They said, well, we know how it goes. She was drinking, you were drinking. She hit you, you hit her back, and this is where we are. It's okay. It's not okay. I maintain I had nothing to do with Pam's injuries, and I didn't. I would not plead to some story that Pam and Pat and Kurt came up with. It was almost 12:15 in the morning when they said I could go. I can't even imagine what I had to endure that Thursday. It still does not even register to me. I am numb with fear, with hurt, with disgust, with loss, and on top of it all, I'm trying to recover from my own injuries, both physical and emotional. One of their comments in their conversation was that I was not acting normal. I ask you, would anybody who had been through what I had been through those 2 days be normal? No, and I probably never will. I was too tired and too hurt to be angry at the time, but I have had lots of time to think about what happened to Pam and me. I am angry at the two people who needlessly took my sweetie from me and in the process destroyed my entire life that I have had to stay behind and live. I am angry at myself for not finding a way to do more or just getting myself killed too. And I'm angry at how badly the law enforcement of our community has treated my situation and the life I enjoyed with Pam. You have no idea who she was, all the good she brought to my life, but all the people around me do, and they loved her like I do, and they're the ones who've helped me to endure this injustice and the pain I feel every day. I had no choice but to face the sadness of my reality last week by planning the services for my wife and taking care of all the other things one must do in such a sad way. I didn't even get a chance to mourn properly, and I am also upset that no attention has been given to the people who did this terrible thing to Pam and me. I've given all the information to the CBI and to Kurt, including a description of the person I remember, and a list of the items they took from our home. I just wanted anyone who had any questions to know what I'm going through, and that I can't recount this every time for everybody. It's just too much for me, so please be patient with me. Look out for yourselves and your neighbors, and please accept my heartfelt thanks for all your prayers, cards, flowers, hugs, and love. On behalf of myself and my beautiful wife, thank you all. Sincerely, Ralph Candelario.
Whew. Whoa.
They were surprised because that's very unusual. Very unusual.
Yeah, I'll say.
I also watched a Dateline app on this called Tangled. So we're in Pueblo. And
it's about Rapunzel and it's starring Mandy Moore. And
yeah, it didn't have to do with this, but I did watch it. So Pam and Ralph are Jehovah's Witnesses, and what happens is that at the time they meet, they're both married to other people. And
eek!
When you're a Jehovah's Witness, you can't get divorced, you can get cast out, you can get shunned. So Pam is married to this guy, Jerry Palmer, and she has two daughters. And her daughter, Shannon, starts to date this kid, Aaron Candelario. So the kids are dating. They're in high school together. After high school, okay. They get engaged, Aaron and Shannon do. And meanwhile, Pam and Ralph...
like, that looks so fun.
Pam and Ralph meet each other chaperoning, like, one of their teen trips, and they end up leaving their spouses for each other. Pam sits down Jerry and she's like, I'm leaving you for Ralph. And he is very upset. Then they sit down their kids and they're like, we're getting married. And the kids are like, we eloped. We got married. And their kids are like, cool. So we're step siblings and we're getting married. Gross. Thanks a lot. You guys are so selfish and weird. Dana Franklin is married to Ralph Candelario at the time. He leaves her for Pam. She goes to the elders of the church and is like, these guys are breaking the rules. And she slashes his tires. Fine. Cool. So Ralph gets in trouble for cheating. Pam stays by him. And they're able eventually to work their way back into the good graces of the church. And the church does eventually recognize this new marriage. So they're still Jehovah's Witnesses. They have a really strained relationship with their kids.
Do you think what they did is they left the church and just waited for a Jehovah's Witness to knock on their door and be like, this sounds like really cool. Okay, sure, we'll join.
That's
and
a really good hack. The kids, their kids end up getting divorced. They're only like married a year and a half, the kids. But Pam.
Christmas must be weird. Well, they don't celebrate holidays. I don't think they don't celebrate holidays.
Well, also Pam just doesn't have like a good relationship with her daughters anymore because I guess the drinking thing is real. Like she does drink a lot and they don't like that she walks around pretending to be like the perfect Christian, but there's all these skeletons in the closet. So then we flash forward to this story that Ralph tells and we just know that 911 gets a call from the neighbor and that they're like, Ralph was running outside the house. He was really upset. He was yelling that he and his wife were attacked. So they get there around 7 a.m. and they find Pam dead inside the house. At first, they think it's a shooting, but then they're like, no, she was bludgeoned. And this is all before this, obviously, this letter doesn't exist yet. So yeah. They're trying to figure out what's happening. The Candelarios had been supposed to be on vacation and go to Oregon, but their flight got delayed. So they were home. And then this happens. So it seems like they were not supposed to be home, and they were. And you can see where that would be a situation where potentially someone's going to burglarize them. The neighbors are totally freaked out. There's a killer on the loose. This is terrifying. At first, they're like, we should look at the ex-husband. He was very upset when she left him for this guy, Ralph. He lives in Nebraska. They're like, oh, you were way too far away to be the person that did this. They're like, what about the kids? The kids were really pissed that their parents got married to each other. And the kids are a total non-starter as well. So they're looking at informants are calling in drug dealers in the neighborhood. And they're looking at them and they're like, they do have like violent history. And it does feel like it could have been a burglary gone wrong. And then Ralph goes into a newspaper because they're looking at him, obviously, and he's angry. And he gives them this insane letter that I read, which is insane because it's pages and pages long. It is so detailed.
And they publish the whole thing.
And it's this idea that you sat down and wrote the longest letter in the world about every minute that happened. This is wild. And they're like, it does answer a lot of questions we were asking him. Like, we were like, hey, it seems like this poker's the murder weapon. Why is it perfectly sitting at the fireplace? And he's in this big letter that I read. He explains that he went to tend the fire, saw blood on it, and put it back where it belonged. There's a lot of stories about when he first walks in, as you could tell from his story, he tells them he doesn't remember anything. But then he writes this letter that's like, I actually remember everything. Yeah. Now, one of the things that happens is he says they were walking all over the house going through drawers, the assailants. He doesn't say it in the letter, but he says it originally. Then they go into his house and take all the knobs off the drawers because they're going to bring them in for DNA testing and stuff. And then you'll notice in the letter, everyone's suddenly wearing LED lit gloves, which you are... Wow.
LED do you do lit finger guts. Dancing?
Yeah.
Finger dancing.
Picturing them wearing those full-on outfits that look like neon like light bodies. Figure. And they're doing that thing in the dark where they're like making it look like
you can call
where they're
me
dancing.
And, yeah. And it wasn't that? That's so crazy.
So
I mean, the best defense is a good offense. And it feels like he is on offense with this letter.
Yeah, it just feels like every question that he's like, I don't remember anything. But the things he does remember, they're like, okay, we're going to test
perfectly
this, that,
justify,
and the other.
Yeah.
And he's like, now I remember everything. So they are like, you seem extra
guilty.
Fishy. This feels really, really off.
And also, no police officer is not going to look at one, the husband, and two, the one who was there the whole time. There's no way they're going to be like, you know what, I'll take your word for it. Or, although there is, if they're
right.
A member of the uniform, if it's another police officer, they'll take their word for it. But
well, I'll tell you what else is pretty crazy. So there's another investigation that's been cold for a number of years, like 12 years, and they start to look at it. Because it has to do with him, where they're like, hold up. In August of 2004, your wife, Dina, Aaron's mom, went missing. She was in Colorado. It was in Pueblo. She left a note saying she was leaving, and then she just never returned. And you adopted her two kids are like just yours. You raised them. But like, what the fuck happened? Where did she go? You told the police that you thought she met someone online and left. But Aaron, her son, has never stopped wondering where she is. And he, from the get-go, was like, Ralph did it. And was looking online, trying to figure it out as a kid. And at like 13, 14, he starts going out by himself to look for his mom's body in coal mines nearby their home. Because he's sure that the dad disposed of her there. He's going
I have a question about Aaron. Mm-hmm. Is Aaron, so Aaron is not his biological kid, but
I actually don't know. But Aaron is suspicious, so going through his stuff, and he ends up finding his mom's passport and his mom's jean jacket she supposedly left in, and his mom's cell phone. It's like, like this doesn't look like she left.
Jesus.
And it's like in his dad's storage. So Shannon, for her part, is like, Aaron never really talked about his mom. It was a really upsetting topic, but he seemed like really distraught always over her. Shannon agrees to help the police go after Ralph, and she has a call with him that they record, and she's asking about that night, and he says something in the call that strikes them as weird, where he's like talking about the assailant, and then he's like, well, I barely laid eyes on them. And he had also just come forward when he wasn't getting enough pity to say that he actually had been embarrassed, but they sexually assaulted him when he went to the bathroom. So, like, the story is changing over and over again. Sometimes he doesn't remember and didn't see anything. Sometimes he was with them for, like, days at a time and totally saw them and they assaulted
and
him.
And it feels crazy, too, that every time he's revealing more information, it's more and more of his own victimization.
Always.
That's what I'm noticing, is it's always escalating on his behalf.
When the police come and look at the home, they find these two antique rugs in the washer. And they're like, what are these? And he's like, I've never seen those before in my life. They're like, that is crazy. You've never
this
seen
ain't
these
ruggable.
Two rugs in your washer.
And they're in the washer?
Like,
this isn't ruggable.
The
burglars that technology
brought
has
rugs to do laundry at your house. They're so like, they go and they test them and they find Pam's blood on them. So he was obviously washing them, trying to get rid of something. But he's like his own worst enemy, because all he has to say is, tell a story about the burglars killing her and there are rugs and they have blood. You know that the rugs have blood on them. Just tell a story that matches that. He's so bad at this. Also, for making up a story, you did not need to pee your pants that many times.
I think when you were telling the story,
times.
It did feel like a lot of, when was he drinking water? When was he replenishing his fluids? Mm-hmm. Like, how much was shit? It
not
was
only
just
that,
a
but
lot.
It's like, to tell a story about your wife getting murdered and be like, I was so cold. I was so chilly. I just kept sleeping. I was so chilly. He sucks at making these stories up.
You know, so, I found, and for reasons we will get into later, criminals have a very good way of making themselves the victim. It's like a very special, it's a special skill. It's amazing to me when people are victimizing other people to be like, I feel cold. I feel chilly.
Yeah. Ugh.
I pooped so myself.
Finally, because the rugs are like one of the final straws where they're like, we can't arrest this guy. When the results come back from the lab, they go to arrest him. Of course, he's fled. They end up finding him, bringing him to court. When they bring him to court, unfortunately, the information on Dina missing is not admissible. So that doesn't get brought into the court because they're just like, we're talking about Pam. When the hearing gets delayed because he tries to slit his wrists and his throat, of course, he doesn't succeed. And then he goes to court.
Further victimization of himself.
He goes to court. They're like, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. And your motive is so stupid. Your motive is just that you couldn't get in trouble with the church again. You couldn't get another divorce and you wanted to be married to somebody else. So you just killed her so that you could be a widower and get married again.
It's so crazy to me to be like, so you commit murder to save yourself from the church? Make it make sense. Make
well, that's
it make
the thing.
Sense
it's like
to
it's
me.
Like, yeah, exactly. The religion part is so wild.
It's, I don't want to say funny because it truly is just disgusting that someone is like that he's murdering again. It's this, it's her husband, it's the man she like agreed. It's just so fucking disgusting. But you're sitting there in all these cases where it's about the church. You're like, isn't, I don't know. I mean, like, adultery is on the Ten Commandments, but so is murder. Maybe the answer is there's either no way out or maybe find another religion where you can divorce.
So while they're doing this in court, he, I don't know if he's trying to pretend to be crazy to get less of a sentence, but he ends up being like, the thing is, Pam's going to be resurrected. And instead of dwelling on this, I just put my hope into that, into the future when she's resurrected.
Oh,
and you're like,
oh my God.
Okay. All right, Ralph. The where we land with Dina is not satisfying. He did pass a polygraph, and it was also discovered that she was corresponding with men online. Some of them have criminal histories. It is possible she went to visit one of those men and was harmed by them. It's possible. She's never been found, but he's
yeah,
never
there
charged
is enough,
with anything.
There is enough, what is the word? There's enough doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They,
like,
he'll never get
any
charged
defense attorney,
for
yeah.
Dina because they never found a body as well. So that's like, but we know it's a guy that killed his wife. So it's not a long shot to think that he killed his other wife.
And he's in prison for the rest of his life?
That's correct.
Okay, good. That's
I did
good.
Also
I mean,
want to end with.
You
this
want
is,
some justice.
In many ways, this is beside the point, but it came up in my research and I was like, what? The apple does not fall far from the tree.
Oh, no.
So shortly after Dina disappeared and Ralph was dating a bunch of women, including Pamela, this is in 2006, his mom, June Candelario, gets sentenced to 3 years in prison for felony child abuse. So her job is that she counsels inmates with emotional problems. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when she goes to work, she puts her grandson, starting at the age of 10, in a cage. So she locks him away while she's at work.
Okay. Okay.
And he spends hours in the fetal position in just like a kennel, basically. He says he feels like he was in a prison in his own home and that when he was in the cage, he felt scared and lonely and that he was not loved by his grandma.
I could understand why a child would not feel loved after being put in a cage. That doesn't feel like a fucking stretch.
And he comes forward when during her sentencing to ask for like leniency for her. After all that. And the defense is she's depressed. She had all these deaths in her family. So her decision making was really off. And she had made a list of ways to kill herself, wrote her own obituary, purchased an urn for herself.
Okay.
So yes, she's not
the same
well.
Victimization, but the same victimization of look at me, I'm sad, I'm depressed, but while abusing other people, while hurting other people. I just think to me, that's yeah. not
and
you.
And the kid
you...
is, the kid's okay now. He got adopted and I think they did like a check-in and it's like, he's doing okay. But it did also, you were like, what was it like to grow up with June yeah. Candelario as
yeah.
a mom, we don't know, but
I'm sure
Ralph
surely
decided
some
that he's
pointers.
Allowed to kill whoever he wants as long as he gets to be
it
married to
needs.
Somebody that will take
oh,
care of
Jesus.
Him. Yeah. So that was my roundabout story about Ralph Candelario, who maybe killed Dina, definitely killed Pam, and who wrote the craziest letter that I cannot believe, and watch the Dateline, because you get to watch like Keith dealing with this letter, and he's like, what in the world?
I also, the idea that this is called Tangled makes me laugh, because it doesn't feel that tangled to me. It feels pretty straightforward. Like, yeah. It feels like, I would call it keratin hair treatment, straight.
Yeah.
That's what I would call the keratin. Episode. Straight up. Or straight up, now tell me. That's what I think I would call it. Wow.
I would.
That's an insane story. Yeah. Thank you for telling that story. That's wild. Okay.
You have to go
to class soon. I have to go to work. It's not fun, but that's just the truth of the matter.
We got one in. We squeezed one in.
We squeezed one out and it feels good. That sounds, you could.
God, gross. Well, it's not true.
Okay. Well, goodbye.
Good luck out there.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.